The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think it's 18 U.S.C. 610 that's a statute related to unlawful intimidation, coercion, or threatening employees to engage in political activity. So while Kelly and Conway can't be criminally prosecuted for retweeting something inappropriate, to the extent that she tells one of her employees to do something to engage in political behavior that they don't want to or coerces them in some way, then she has violated a criminal statute. That kind of Hatch Act federal law interplay has never really been brought up thus far that I'm aware of, but that is at least still available to DOJ for super flagrant violations.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 8th, 2020. The Hatch Act has been in the news a lot recently. Between the Republican National Convention's use of the White House grounds and Secretary Pompeo's decision to address the convention from an official trip in Jerusalem. What does the law really require? What does it forbid? And what does it permit? We decided to do a deep dive, and we asked Amanda Kane Rapp, senior counsel at the law firm of Akin Gump, to come on and talk it through with us. She worked in the White House counsel's office during the Obama administration on vetting and ethics issues. And Scott Anderson, Lawfare senior editor, joined us as well. He worked on similar issues in the State Department legal advisor's office. We talked about whether the RNC violated the Hatch Act. We talked about where the rules come from. And we talked about how in the future they might be changed. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 8th. Everything you wanted to know about the Hatch Act, but were afraid to ask. I want to start with the most frequent source of error about the Hatch Act. Amanda, get us started. Was this named for Orrin Hatch? And when does the Hatch Act in fact date to?
It was not, in fact, named for Orrin Hatch. The Hatch Act dates back to 1939, which is, in fact, even before Orrin Hatch's time. And it dates back to some criticism related to New Deal era politics. And at the time, there was a need to push back against perceived use of New Deal programs for inappropriate gain.
And what were the nature of the concerns that led to the passage of this law, and what does it actually prohibit? Before we get to why it's in the news these days, you know, what are the parameters of the prohibition, and what were the prior abuses or concerns that you refer to that led to it?
Well, I think the concerns that led to its passage in the 30s are the same as the concerns that people have today. What happened was during the Works Progress Administration, there were allegations that members of the Democratic Party were going into swing states, which at the time included states like Kentucky and Tennessee, and basically using Works Progress Administration administrators and caseworkers to pressure people to their own political advantage. To be honest, I don't know whether there's truth to that or not, but that is what led to the passage of the act in the first place. At the time, you know, I think President Roosevelt, he was concerned about things that were happening within the Democratic Party and losing some conservative Democrats. You know, there was a lot of back and forth over the legislation. at the very last minute, he decided to sign it. And that is fundamentally the legislation we're dealing with today.
And what does it prohibit?
Well, it prohibits a lot of things that people think it does. And then again, it doesn't prohibit everything that we're seeing in the news lately. So in general, it's prohibiting every civilian executive branch employee from inappropriately using their, you know, authority or title or powers in their position to affect the result of an election. So what that breaks down to is a couple of different bucket areas. You're not allowed to use your authority or influence to interfere with a specific election. If you're a civilian executive branch employee, you're not allowed to kind of solicit donations or contributions related to partisan political races. You yourself cannot run for partisan political office. And interestingly, this ends up being a surprising bulk of Hatch Act violations where people think they can run for local school board when they can't. And it also, you know, prohibits engaging in political activity in certain spheres. So when you're on duty at your job, if you're in some sort of federal room or building, if you're wearing any official insignia, or if you're using a federal vehicle. So this is all designed, again, to not let executive branch employees misuse their position or misuse the resources they've been granted.
All right. So Scott, give us an overview of the current spate of activities that have made the Hatch Act so much a part of the news and has made Orrin Hatch tweet that, as Amanda said, it's not his law.
Well, it really all comes back to the Republican National Convention that was held last week in Washington, D.C., among other locales around the country, kind of brought together virtually. And in the lead up to the RNC, the Trump administration indicated that President Trump intended to both present in a number of sort of circumstances to the RNC from the White House, and then ultimately provide a speech from the Rose Garden, or at least from the outside of the White House. I actually don't think it was technically in the Rose Garden, accepting the nomination from the Republican Party for the role of president. And this is a departure. Usually we have seen presidential candidates certainly attend the convention, which are usually held on private property, not on public property. It's a little different this year because of the COVID, I think, for understandable reasons. But we generally do not see presidents engaging in something that is clearly a partisan event, arguably the most partisan an event can get, on federal property, let alone the People's House, the White House. In addition to President Trump's speech to accept the nomination, at the RNC, they played a number of videos and a number of sort of live events where the president was engaging in different official activities from the White House. So a swearing-in ceremony, a panel with people who had been released from hostage situations during the Trump administration's tenure, some of which were pre-recorded, at least one of which I believe was live with the RNC feed. We also saw First Lady Melania Trump give a speech from the Rose Garden the night before President Trump accepted the nomination, giving her own sort of floor speech for the candidacy of her husband. And then we saw, after President Trump accepted the nomination, we saw that most Trumpy of events and celebrations. We saw a fireworks display outside the Washington Monument, which the RNC got a permit from the Park Service. But nonetheless, is one of these things we usually associate with a national holiday or something to that extent, to the extent where I believe, having not seen it myself, it actually spelled Trump's name in the fireworks in the sky over the Washington Monument, is my understanding from the media reports. Separate from this, outside the White House itself, we also had a separate set of activities engaged in by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was on a trip in the Middle East and in other areas through most of the RNC. That said, he evidently was interested in participating because on a stop in Jerusalem, he took an hour or two out of his schedule to put himself on the roof of the King David Hotel, which for those who've been to Jerusalem, or for those who haven't, it is a classic old hotel that kind of overlooks the old city of Jerusalem, which of course President Trump very notably recognized as the capital of Israel early in his administration. And from there, Pompeo gave a speech essentially trumpeting the victories that the Trump administration had on foreign policy, essentially endorsing President Trump for another 4 years. This is, again, pretty exceptional. No Secretary of State in recent memory has attended the RNC. They've consciously, or the DNC, I should say, they've consciously avoided it as part of a policy where national security cabinet officials, including the Attorney General, Secretary of Defense, normally have not attended these things. The last Secretary of State who was in office that I could find on record about what she did was Hillary Clinton, and she was on a trip literally literally halfway around the world when her husband spoke. And of course, she had, was a prior presidential candidate and future presidential candidate in 2012 when that happened. The other thing Pompeo did is that he actually engaged in this activity while on an overseas trip, which raises problems with State Department's own policies separate and apart from the Hatch Act and some of these other statutory restrictions, which we can get to in a minute. Now, Secretary Pompeo said, I did this all in my personal capacity. I did not use taxpayer money, at least, although it's not clear how he divided the line between what was the official trip and what was his kind of field trip to the roof of the King David Hotel. But nonetheless, he has a case saying, here's why I think this was appropriate. But it doesn't, as far as I can tell, address those State Department policies. Instead, it's really oriented towards Hatch Act legislative restrictions, not the longstanding State Department policies that normally apply to other diplomats operating overseas.
All right. So looking at this, a lot of people have said these are Hatch Act violations, or they're at least gross violations of the spirit of the Hatch Act. Amanda, how clear is it to you that any of this activity actually violates the Hatch Act on the part of Secretary Pompeo, on the part of the president, or on the part of anybody who works for the White House?
It's still very unclear to me. Despite the pat description I gave you all earlier about what the Hatch Act actually prohibits, there are tons of nuances and uncertainties built into the law. And what you've seen up until this administration is, because of those uncertainties and because of the kind of political and communications risks, administrations, specifically with their political appointees, have really shied away from even delving into what the Hatch Act might and might not permit in the grayest areas of laws. So, for example, in 2016, the White House issued an edict forbidding cabinet secretaries from attending the DNC. This was to follow the spirit of the Hatch Act, but certainly wasn't required by it. And so we've never really seen so many test cases of what the Hatch Act actually does and does not prohibit, specifically in a relatively unique situation where you do have a convention that is entirely virtual in some respects, and everyone can't gather in a big hotel room. For Secretary Pompeo in particular, I think Scott's right to identify that there are many longstanding State Department specific policies that it appears that he did not follow. Specifically, Office of Legal Advisor has a policy out that said any Senate confirmed appointee from the State Department, regardless of, you know, where they are in the world or where their post is not supposed to attend a political convention. Whether attendance is technically happening here, where he's giving a speech from Israel, I'm not really sure, but it certainly seems to not follow the spirit of that guidance. Whether any other issues involved with the RNC were Hatch Act violations, I think we need to know more facts about who did what. A lot of political appointees and White House appointees are exempt from specific provisions of the Hatch Act. For example, the president and the vice president, by definition, cannot violate the Hatch Act. The first lady is not a federal employee. She cannot violate the Hatch Act. You have to be on federal property engaging in political activity to violate that provision of the Hatch Act. The South Lawn, the Rose Garden, and the residents are not federal property. So you see how it becomes very nuanced.
Wait, pause over that. In what sense is the South Lawn not federal property or the Rose Garden? I mean, I live near there, you know, a few miles away. I don't know of anyone else who owns it.
So again, this is how you see it can become very tricky, specifically for the White House employees, to know where and when they can engage in political activity and how, when you work on the White House grounds, because the White House serves two functions. It is both a place of business, but it's also the president's personal residence. And there has been a determination made specifically that the Rose Garden, the South Lawn, and certain aspects of the residence, the map room, that for the purposes of the Hatch Act, those are not federal property. Otherwise, it becomes somewhat unworkable for people to constantly have to leave the building. And those parts are just seen as non-business areas. Now, I know, practically speaking, you know, we know the Rose Garden as where the press conferences are held. The South Lawn has official events all the time. But for the purposes of the Hatch Act and the Office of Special Counsel, that's how the law has been interpreted.
Okay, so we have a blanket exemption for the president and the vice president. The first lady isn't covered at all. certain areas of the White House grounds are not considered federal property, not because they're not owned by the federal government, but because they're kind of just definitionally considered part of the president's residence in which he's allowed to engage in politicking. And so, because he's got to be able to in his own house, and therefore people who may be helping him with that, it's like considered like being in his private study or something rather than in a federal office.
Exactly.
And then finally, there's this other issue, which is that presumably the expenses associated with conducting this are being picked up by the campaign. So it's not like the federal government is subsidizing the campaign, at least any more than it normally does, with by providing the president with security and wherever he goes. And so my question is, why has nobody figured this out before and done it before? It seems like these various loopholes put together are kind of a yawning chasm. Why has it never been exploited before?
I'd be interested in Scott's opinion on this too. You know, I think that it hasn't been exploited in this way before because no one had an interest or a need to exploit it in this way before. There has never been a need to conduct as much political business or business in general in our homes, and the president is in his home. And so in that sense, you know, it was a perfect storm timing to try something like this at the White House. But I also think there just wasn't an appetite to engage in this. There, in past administrations, there has been clear guidance from both, you know, the White House, but also the Office of Special Counsel on maintaining the division between the president, the candidate, and the presidency. And it's just easier to not have anything about the president, the candidate, or politics come into the building, so to speak. I know that in our administration, which was incredibly conservative on these issues, there was a lot of pushback because a lot of times people were told not to do things that frankly went above and beyond what the Hatch Act would require. But it was just cleaner that way. It was just easier. And no one wanted to deal with the questions or the scandals. But, you know, it seems this administration has taken a different viewpoint towards that. And the risk is worth the reward for them.
All right, Scott. So how obvious is it to you that any of this activity exceeds the law?
So there's a question of the law, and there's the question of the values that the law is supposed to serve. I think we need to segregate those out a little bit because they're both important. Technical legal determinations are tied into certain legal consequences that might apply. Notably, for a lot of these restrictions, a lot of these government rules, there actually aren't very clear sanctions attached to them. Certainly, if no higher level official wants to enforce them, and there's no higher level official than the president. But there are still important values that they serve. Remember that the Hatch Act and the State Department guidelines and other rules like this are things that apply to every single civil servant employee. Everybody who joins the government has to play by these basic rules. It's so important that even unpaid interns in federal agencies have to comply with these sorts of restrictions and can face sanctions if they don't. And yet, for some reason, the president and the secretary of state appear to have thought it is not important for them to do so. It may very well be legal by a technical reading of the law. This administration has not hesitated in other, frankly, far more consequential contexts to really play brinkmanship with the law, to push the law to its limits, knowing that, particularly in the separation of power space, and particularly when you're dealing with the presidency, there often are not very clear legal sanctions that are going to catch up with you, even if your view of the law is quite a departure from what most people would say is the right view of the law. So I'm not sure that's the right standard we should be looking at it here. I think the real standard is, what is the intent of these officials in doing this, and how appropriate is it? Does it serve values that we like? And I want to go back to one thing Amanda said, which I think was a very generous take on their motivations here, was talking about the necessity in light of COVID of having this remote convention, the president acting from his home. And these are points that we've heard the administration echo, but they're not persuasive remotely in this particular case. We have to bear in mind, President Trump leaves his house all the time, has engaged in a number of political events in different parts of the country, including large rallies with people not wearing masks or abiding by his own administration's public health guidelines in regards to COVID. So that is not a barrier for him. He also has a Trump Organization hotel in the same city just blocks away, where he could have held an event and has held events, similar events in the past, but chose not to do it here.
In fact, he could have paid himself to hold an event there.
Exactly. And this might be the one case in which people would have found that less problematic than what he actually did, whereas usually that is a big ethical problem for him. On top of that, not only did the president say, oh, I'm going to do this all from my house, and he mingled in his official duties with the swearing-in ceremony, with this talk about hostage policy, in with these campaign events, which is more problematic, although I suspect part of that is because he was trying to build a case to say, well, look, I'm really just doing my job, and I'm just letting the camera be here. But it's a hard case, particularly if you watch those events, which have a very campaign-y advocacy-type feel. On top of that, you have, once again, the fireworks display, which I don't think there's anything legally wrong with the fireworks display, as far as I'm aware, although we don't know exactly what he did to get the requisite permits. And I certainly, as a DC native who's lived here almost my entire life, never recall a similar event where a private organization has held a fireworks display like that from the Washington Monument. But what I do think it symbolizes is this, is that this president is not just being forced to do things from his house, he's deliberately wrapping himself in the vestiges of the office of the presidency and the government. This is somebody who rode in on allegations of the swamp and continues to talk about the deep state, accuses countless government employees of being against him, says they're all corrupt, they're all serving their own interests. And now he is taking all of these vestiges of government, all of these symbols that signify the power and authority he wields as president, and he's wrapping himself in them as he's going to his party and saying, give me four more years. And that's problematic. That is a step that no prior administration I think would have thought was appropriate. And I think they would have expected, frankly, to suffer political costs for it. But the Trump administration appears to be betting on the fact that they will not suffer those political costs. And certainly, at least within the Republican circles at the RNC, they don't appear to have done so. Instead, we saw the RNC really play along, celebrate the president. No one acted as if anything was wrong with this or raised any objections. They essentially just made themselves accomplices to the whole endeavor.
All right. So Scott made reference, Amanda, to the somewhat unusual enforcement mechanism of the Hatch Act, which I think a lot of people don't understand. So I want you to walk us through how the Hatch Act is supposed to work from an enforcement perspective, and why this administration has been able to avoid that enforcement mechanism, at least for senior White House officials.
Yeah, I think the enforcement mechanism is misunderstood, and partially possibly because it will disappoint many people who are upset right now. I've seen a lot of tweets about how DOJ needs to do its job and throw these criminals in jail. And I have to stop myself and say, well, it's not a criminal statute. It's actually an administrative statute. It's administered by the U.S. Office of the Special Counsel, separate from Robert Mueller's Special Counsel. This is an independent agency with one political appointee at the top. And in addition to Hatch Act investigating and dealing with Hatch Act issues, they also deal with whistleblowers and a variety of other personnel-related matters. So what will happen is the Office of the Special Counsel will get a complaint. In theory, they could also kind of start their own investigation, but what usually happens is they get a complaint or a referral about a potential violation, and they conduct an investigation. Just like any other investigation, it might involve asking for documents, doing interviews, and as I alluded to earlier, it's a really fact-specific inquiry, so depending on how complex the potential violation is, it may take a little while for them to get all the facts they need. They'll then look at all those facts and either write a letter of no violation, which actually does happen quite frequently, or they'll determine there was a Hatch Act violation and then decide what the appropriate course of action would be. What they'll usually start with is issuing a warning letter to the subject and advising them to get some more ethics counseling. So this is what you saw probably in late 2017, early 2018, when the office started investigating Kellyanne Conway's tweets. That, I think, was the most famous Hatch Act issue of this administration until recently. And they'll say to the subject, look, you messed up, probably not intentionally, you didn't know. Here's how you can remediate the issue. And also, by the way, get a refresher on your ethics training from your agency ethics official. They'll also attempt to informally resolve the situation. So this has become a more normal route recently when a lot of ethics violations have involved Twitter. Earlier in this administration, I think there was a lot of misunderstandings of what people could and could not do with what they thought their official versus unofficial Twitter accounts were. And so what OSC would say to people is, hey, take down the tweet. And then, you know, that in theory kind of helps their violation and also helps with their intent. For more serious issues or when people are repeat offenders, they have been counseled on issues and then they do it again. Either OSC will negotiate some sort of settlement with them and say, here's what you're going to do. You're going to pay a fine. You're going to take a downgrade in your GS scale, something like that. And that'll resolve the issue. For the most serious cases for non-political appointees, they'll prosecute a case before the Merit Service Protection Board and again, pursue those kinds of remedies. But they're very light remedies. Again, they're sometimes removal from federal office, reduction in grade, civil penalties of not to exceeding $1,000. And those are all the remedies for non-political appointees. For political appointees, it's a little bit more, it's even softer. Political appointees are entirely governed by the president. So the statute specifically gives the president the power over political appointees who are set and confirmed and anyone paid through the executive office of the president. And then OSC has taken the overall view that the president is the only person with the power to remove or reprimand all political appointees across the government.
So in other words, the reason that Kellyanne Conway doesn't have anything to fear from the Hatch Act is because Donald Trump doesn't care, right? Or even enjoys what she does.
Exactly. Whereas in past administrations, you know, for Kellyanne Conway in particular, the Office of Special Counsel has sent the White House repeated letters and up to and including a letter saying you should fire this person. I can't think of an example of that ever happening before. And even thinking hypothetically, 3 or 4 steps before that, that person would have no longer worked at the White House in previous administrations.
Yeah. So let's take an example that I'm confident I can ask you about without asking you to violate any privilege, because the matter is so unthinkable that I'm really confident that there's no conversations you would have ever had with a client in which it came up. But the rough equivalent to Kellyanne Conway in the Obama White House was Valerie Jarrett, right? Or, you know, one of a very small number of extremely close advisors. And so I'm imagining a situation in which Valerie Jarrett had repeated interactions with the Office of Special Counsel such that they publicly reprimanded her or publicly warned her about tweets and appearances in which on television in which she endorsed family products, I don't know, buy this book or something, and then finally threw up their hands and recommended that Valerie Jarrett be fired. All of which, in fact, happened with Kellyanne Conway. So I'm just thinking about, like, in a different White House, in a more normal White House, what happens when the Special Office of Special Counsel starts saying, hey, wait a minute, we have a problem with the way Valerie Jarrett's behaving?
And I literally can't even answer that question because I'm laughing so hard thinking about that hypothetical. That is so
it's a
far beyond
hypothetical, though, right?
It's
literally the situation we're dealing with.
But knowing the players involved and picturing any part of it is just giving me a tickle. Let me give you a slightly different example, because that is so far beyond even being able to answer. One of the things that I did at the White House was vetting new political appointees. So anyone from a cabinet secretary down to a Schedule C special assistant. And I reviewed FBI files for certain levels of political appointees. That is part of our vetting process. If you are ever in your government career investigated for a Hatch Act violation by the Office of Special Counsel, it usually ends up in your FBI file, even if it's closed with no issue involved. If I saw that in an FBI file, that would be something that I, as a vetting attorney, before you got a promotion or a new job within the government, would spend ample time doing an independent investigation on, even knowing that the Office of Special Counsel had concluded that no Hatch Act violation occurred. So that's as close as I can get to your hypothetical.
Just to push you a little bit further, if you found that the Office of Special Counsel in a hypothetical situation had found repeated violations by somebody, it's fair to say that that person would not survive vetting.
I think that is very fair to say.
All right. So I want to talk to you both about the future of this law, because I can argue this either way. One part of me says, actually, we don't really have a legal problem here. What we have is a Donald Trump problem. And the Hatch Act worked reasonably well for administrations of both parties over, I think it was passed in 1939. So it's, you know, a lot of years at this point. And the premise that the enforcement would work because presidents would care is actually a valid premise as a general matter. And so the real problem here is the personality of the individual, not the structure of the law. The other side of me says, hang on a second. You know, you got to have your Oliver Wendell Holmes bad man theory of the law here. The law is not meant merely to restrain the good guys. It's meant to regulate the behavior of the bad guys. And here we have a situation that really shows this law is inadequate to rein in the behavior of, say, Kellyanne Conway or the Republican National Committee when the president doesn't care or enjoys that activity. So my question is, which side of me is right? Is this a legal problem or is this a political problem that you deal with by electing a different president? Scott, what do you think?
It's a good question. You know, I suspect it's both. President Trump is, and frankly, many of the people in his administration have proven uniquely not sensitive to norms, not sensitive to the normal sort of political pressures we're used to other administrations dealing with. And that's amplified their ability to get away with this sort of behavior because they're just not as worried about, you know, the actual opprobrium that would come to it that other people might have been worried about chasing them throughout the rest of their public careers. But part of the reason they're not worried about it is because they don't think real political consequences will flow from it, meaning that the thing that usually keeps people afraid of violating these sorts of rules, they are not afraid of. And they may be right or they may be wrong about that. That's what we have to see in this next election and frankly, in how the Republican Party sort of responds if there is some sort of backlash. Do they start taking these issues more seriously or do they remain on the sort of more bend where they're less susceptible to these sorts of norms? Regardless, I think there's a good argument here to say that we need to have some sort of stronger and more automatic safeguards built in, particularly for the civil servants that are trying to navigate this very tricky atmosphere and are being put in very difficult positions by political appointees around them. The difficulty is always going to be a tension between Congress and the executive branch over who controls executive branch personnel. And the executive branch often is going to win on that, even in the rare occasion where the courts will actually weigh in. You know, there's enough of a kind of dominant view that the executive branch gets control most personnel appointees, certainly for political appointees, which are the kind of biggest problem here. But you can imagine mechanisms Congress could adopt, and it probably would have to be Congress in a way to make them binding on future administrations that would make it trickier for future presidential administrations to get past this. One way would be to invoke some sort of automatic sanction that kicks in when certain triggers are triggered, but then give a waiver for the president to invoke it. We see that sort of structure in lots of other areas where the president has a lot of authority, like foreign affairs, national security, and it lets Congress basically ratchet up the political pressure if the president wants to do something contrary to its desires. Maybe they constitutionally can't tell the president he can't, but they can make it more painful for him. And I think it may be time that Congress starts considering about those sorts of measures in this space, even if they're not ready to go further and start asserting more authority directly over presidential appointees. And frankly, I'm not sure how much more they can as a firm matter, but they can structure the sort of decisions and mechanisms in place to create stronger incentives for compliance, even among people in President Trump's position.
What do you think, Amanda? Is the problem the person or the problem the law?
It is a hard question. I go back and forth on this on a number of areas of law in this administration, as I'm sure you both do as well. I think it's the person, and I'm hesitant to suggest that we rewrite law to constrain a worst case scenario of a person. being president. And I think you have to choose one or the other. Are we optimistic that this is a worst case scenario and that laws are not should not be designed to keep our president from violating norms we've agreed upon for hundreds of years? Or should we be more cautious and not as reliant on some of these norms that we have been up until this point? I do think Scott makes a good point that in other areas, the law could use a refresh. It's been, I think, amended as late as 2012, but obviously it didn't contemplate certain scenarios, such as the fact that a naturalization ceremony could be live streamed, posted on the White House website, and therefore publicly accessible and usable in a political sense. These are technological advances, are not things that the law really had taken into account. And I think that's what makes some of this situation with the RNC recently a little bit more cautious about, we should be a little bit more cautious about drawing conclusions about them. But I do see, I can imagine being a federal civil servant who can't bring my Biden-Harris sticker to work on my water bottle, but I see the president throwing convention on the White House lawns. Obviously, there's some disconnect there, and there could be a look at the law there to make it easier for federal civil servants to understand what they can and cannot do and why it makes sense for them to be restricted in ways that the president maybe is not.
One question for you both before we wrap. I have a certain amount of sympathy with the Twitter people who, not understanding the statute, say, wait a minute, where's the criminal enforcement here? Now, there is no criminal enforcement because it's not a criminal statute. But my question is, should certain knowing and willful and flagrant violations of it be criminal? So the first time that Kellyanne Conway does something like what she did, you know, promoting use of products, she gets a little letter. The fifth time, at the point at which the Office of Special Counsel actually asked for her firing, and I believe when they were accused by the White House of behaving in an extraordinary fashion, the special counsel responded, yeah, there's something else that's extraordinary here, Kellyanne Conway's behavior, right? There's certain knowing, intentional, willful violations of the statute that seem to me plausibly ask for criminal sanction. And so my question is, you know, should there be at some point in this statutory regime criminal teeth?
I think not. The statute is designed to curtail executive branch employees in their behavior and design them from misusing their position and their influence. And it's not designed to punish speech. I do wonder, and Scott may have more thoughts on this than I do, whether attaching criminal liability to it may run afoul of some constitutional protections. The last time that the statute was challenged in court was the 40s, and it's never really successfully been challenged in any way since. But I do wonder if criminal penalties would enhance the scrutiny related to that. I should also note, Ben, that even though the Hatch Act doesn't have criminal penalties, there are still laws on the books, both federally and state, that do allow DOJ to bring prosecutions for kind of related behavior. So there's, I think it's 18 U.S.C. 610, that's a statute related to unlawful intimidation, coercion, or threatening employees to engage in political activity. So while Kellyanne Conway can't be criminally prosecuted for retweeting something inappropriate, to the extent that she tells one of her employees to do something to engage in political behavior that they don't want to or coerces them in some way, then she has violated a criminal statute. That kind of Hatch Act federal law interplay has never really been brought up thus far that I'm aware of, but that is at least still available to DOJ for super flagrant violations.
Yeah, I'll second what Amanda said and go maybe one step further even and say, I think people who look to the criminal law for resolution in this situation are barking up the wrong tree. I think we have a really close parallel, frankly, actually, and it's actually a criminal law provision that comes up in some of these ethics contexts, and that's the Anti-Deficiency Act, right? There's a criminal violation on the books that says if executive branch officials misuse appropriated funds, then they can face criminal prosecution for it. And in theory, this could be real sanction. And a lot of people argue this does have an impact inside the government about lawyers warning their policy clients, hey guys, you know, you got to do what Congress says or else you're going to face the United Deficiency Act prosecution. And like I said, it comes up in ethical questions. If the president misappropriates funds for one purpose to use them for political purpose, as maybe happened around some of the White House activities, although, you know, the, I think the legal case there is not strongest, then that could in theory be an Anti-Deficiency Act violation. The problem is that nobody's ever brought an Anti-Deficiency Act prosecution. Just as a lot of these other laws that are actually on the books that could cover this sort of conduct have either never been used or have never been used to cover this sorts of conduct in regards to the presidency and senior executive branch officials. That has a lot to do with prosecutorial discretion. It has a lot to do with the separation of powers questions and other constitutional questions that Amanda raised, that both the Justice Department, even when acting independently of any sort of political pressure, often shies away from in contexts like this and tries to play a more small c conservative approach. Certainly the courts do the same. And so it's hard for me to imagine a criminal violation that could be on the books and we would likely ever be used, because we just don't see parallel provisions being used in similar contexts. The real answer here is political pressure. It's people getting and holding their officials accountable and members of Congress accountable to hold their officials accountable by voting, and then installing bureaucratic mechanisms that ramp up those political pressures, that by mechanisms, like I said, that maybe automatically impose certain career sanctions unless waived, or that automatically disclose things to Congress or to the public. There's a lot can be done to do a lot more naming and shaming and bringing public attention to this. But ultimately, if the voters don't care, then the politicians aren't going to care. And that's really where the nub has to be, is with people taking these issues and deciding these values are important enough to drive them to the ballot box.
We're going to leave it there. Amanda Kane Rapp, Scott Anderson, thanks so much for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet about it, share it on Facebook, upvote it on Reddit, and pin it on Pinterest. You can get your Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.